And this is Ms. G, and I am back with a story for you tonight. The first story starts off, Summer Notes, and Karen Parker proves that grandparents really are awesome. They were sitting on the screen porch in the late afternoon, the old man and the child. She was cross-legged on the day bed, eating graham crackers spread with honey, and she brushed crumbs from her shorts and T-shirt onto the sandy blanket. Her grandfather was moving gently in a large rocking chair. It drove well. Somewhere along the row of cottages, a screen door slammed, then slammed again. Must be the Metcalf twins, Emily thought. The door on this cottage had lost its coiled spring, so it didn't close on its own. You had to bang it shut. She wished her dad had noticed this when he rented the cottage and asked that it be fixed. Emily licked her fingers. Her granddad didn't mind if she ate before supper. She was glad that her mother was gone to the beach for the afternoon. She hoped her granddad decided to stay with them when they went home at the end of the summer. He didn't shave his whiskers every day like her dad did. His face was bristly, then clean for a day, then bristly. Emily looked at him admiringly. He felt her look, glanced at her, smiled. They got on well together. A sigh of contentment over the snack came out of her as she drew her knees up under her chin. She put her cheek on her knees. Granddad continued to rock slowly. A group of boys were throwing a ball over a cottage a street away. Their cry of eeny, eeny, eenor, here the ball comes over, drifted lazily across the heat. Emily rubbed her cheek across her knees. "What's a suicide?" she asked. "Hmm?" asked Granddad drowsily. "Suicide. What is it?" "When you kill yourself." "Oh, I thought so." He squinted one eye at her. "Why did you want to know?" Emily ran her fingers along a scratch on her leg. It was forming a ridge. "I just wondered. I heard some people talking and they said there'd have to be a suicide." Her grandfather rocked and thought for a moment. "You must have misunderstood. You don't do a suicide. You do a murder. I mean, a suicide is self-directed. You must have heard wrong." "No," said Emily. "That's what they said." "Who?" "The people." One thing he had learned in life, patience. "What people?" he asked, and the lack of irritation in his voice encouraged her to explain. "I was sitting under the dock." She glanced at him, but he didn't look alarmed. "And two people walked out to the water, and the man said, it would have to be a suicide, and the lady said, I agree. And then they walked back and didn't say anything until they were on land, and she said, you'll have to arrange it, and he said, I know. And then they were gone." Chet stopped rocking. He looked at his granddaughter, and she looked back. He'd gotten to know her pretty well these past weeks. Before that, he'd only seen her once or twice a year. She was bright for 8 years old. He took her seriously. "Did they see you?" he asked. "No, I was underneath. You have to crawl on the bank. Don't tell Mom. And sort of squeeze through by some rocks. But it's nice, like a cave."
"Could you see them?"
"No."
"Well, that settles that," Chet said.
He went back to rocking. Emily checked between her toes for sand. "I know who they are," she said. He stopped rocking again.
"How?"
"I seen them."
"Saw," he corrected.
"Saw," she said. "Them a few times in the store buying soda pops. I recognize her voice. She's real pretty. She hisses when she talks."
"Hisses?"
"She says, this is the way to drink from a straw."
"Oh," he went back to rocking.
The late afternoon air was hot and stale. One of the locals, the man who delivered blocks for those still using ice boxes, said the daily doldrums happened because all the land breeze had blown out to sea, and there was a lapse before it began to blow back. "You feeling okay, Dad?" Alice asked at supper.
"Sure," he said. "Why?"
"You seem quiet."
"Just thinking, I guess.
I like this newfangled meal. What did you call them? Open-faced sandwiches?"
Alice grinned at Bert, who was eating a bit reluctantly. He liked his supper to be hot and hearty.
I'm glad you like them. If I'm going to be a beach bunny all afternoon, I have to make a quick meal. No fussing.
I offered to buy fish and chips on the way home, Bert grumbled good-naturedly. Too greasy. All that oil I put on my body made me not want to eat anything cooked in it.
Oh, Mom, that's awful, said Emily. She made a face.
After supper, her grandfather suggested a walk. The cicadas were still shrilling. They walked along the narrow, dusty road between the rows of cottages. There was a breeze now. It smelled damp and fishy, but not unpleasant.
I wish it was always light at night, she told him. I like going to bed before it's dark.
Are you afraid of the dark? He wanted to know.
Sort of.
Well, one night we'll make friends with it. Then you'll never be frightened again, he told her.
Really?
She asked.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped in front of the store. Want to share a popsicle?
Sure.
They had a bit of discussion over what flavor. Emily did not want chocolate. Her gramps wasn't partial to orange. They settled on root beer.
Are those people here? He asked casually when they were standing at the cash register.
Nope, she said, knowing who he meant. She was anxious in case the popsicle broke unevenly and they'd only have part on the stick and the rest in their fingers. It melted so fast and her hands got sticky. But the popsicle broke neatly and evenly.
You're a popsicle expert, she told the storekeeper when he had smacked it on the counter and divided it exactly in half.
Thank you, he said.
The next day they went to the store twice, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. The couple was not there.
Emily's mother did not go to the beach that day, so Emily did not have an afternoon snack. When the cottage got hot from supper preparations, if I boil water, this place heats up, her mother complained again and again. Emily and her gramps went outside and sat on the fallen tree at the end of the street. They could see the harbor from there, and two little boys were on a stoop nearby blowing bubbles.
I wish you could poke bubbles and they wouldn't break, she commented. And then in the same tone of voice, matter-of-factly, she said, That's them, and slightly inclined her head toward a passing car with a couple inside.
Part of Chet's mind marveled that she was so discreet, even at 8 years old. She knew darn well he had gone by the store twice to see if they were there. She knew he was curious and interested. He would have expected her to shout and point. Alice, as a child, would have done so. The rest of his mind was in amazed shock. The man in the car was the owner of the large inn at the center of this holiday town. The woman was his receptionist. He knew the wife of the innkeeper when he saw her. Pleasant, middle-aged, mother of two sons, a suitable companion for her middle-aged husband. The receptionist was a bit of a floozy, Chet thought, and likely half his age. Chet didn't sleep very well that night. He kept thinking of the words, have to be a suicide. The remonstrances, don't be a fool, it's none of your business, and she likely heard wrong, helped, but not for long. Somewhere near dawn, he made a decision, and then he slept soundly. At breakfast, it was his turn to work the ancient toaster with the flip-down sides.
It's going to be another scorcher, Bert announced.
He said this every morning, and it always was.
Don't forget I like my toast dark on one side and light on the other, Emily reminded her gramps.
What are you going to do when we go home and you have to put up with the pop-up toaster again?
Emily shrugged. It was silly trying to figure out things ahead of time. How could she know now how she would feel then?
The perils of progress, murmured Chet.
Well, let's do the groceries early, Alice said. You coming, Dad?
Nope, I think I'll stay, he answered. I intend to just relax and read.
He added quickly as Emily looked over at him, and he was afraid she would want to stay with him.
When they had gone, he got Alice's rubber gloves from under the sink. They felt wet inside. He didn't know how she could stand to wear them. He liked the feel of soapy water on his hands. Then he shut himself in his room with a newspaper, an old jar of mucilage he'd seen in a cupboard, the scissors. Already it was hot in the room, but he did not push the flowered chintz that acted as curtains back on the string that doubled as a cotton rod. He left them closed. He leaned back against the wall and peered out the crack between the curtains and the window. He could only see a few feet of the cottage next door. Then, when he'd put stuff out on the bed and sat down on the rickety chair beside it, Mrs. Ambrose, next door, called out something to one of her kids.
and Chet jumped guiltily. Just not cut out for this sort of thing, he told himself as he got to work. An hour or so later, he had two letters written in words cut from the newspaper and pasted onto plain white paper. The first one said, "The only suicide to happen had better be yours." In block letters, he addressed an envelope to the innkeeper at the inn. It felt weird to write with rubber gloves on. He debated a bit more before making the second letter, but he went ahead. It said, "Someone is out to hurt you. Take care. A friend." He addressed it to the innkeeper's wife at their home address. He'd used water to put the stamps on the envelopes, feeling overcautious. Then he put the glue and gloves and scissors back and ripped the cut newspaper pages of the newspaper into shreds, which he flushed down the toilet. With a quick glance up and down the street to make sure Alice and Bert weren't on their way home, he went around the cottage and across to the next road by the back route. Several trees away, he located a mailbox and dropped the envelopes inside. "Well, that's that," he said to himself. A day later, Chet and Emily were on their way to the beach. "Do you want to see if those people are in the store?" she asked him. "No, I don't need to. I took care of it," he said. "Oh," she said, and looked at him, but did not ask anything more. The next day, Chet saw the receptionist in the laundromat. She looked tired. Chet wondered if something was bothering her sleep. He thought he should feel pleased, but he didn't. He felt empty, but somehow satisfied. On the weekend, Bert added to the lunchtime conversation by commenting, "Saw a police car in front of the innkeeper's house today." "Wonder why?" Alice asked. "I hope the boys are okay." The eldest boy worked in the local drugstore and was friendly and helpful. "Maybe a problem at the inn?" Bert said. "Likely that," Chet agreed. The rest of the summer passed uneventfully. Emily crawled several times under the dock, but she didn't hear any more interesting conversations. Chet decided he could put up with his daughter's family, and they with him. So he started to make plans to close down his apartment and move in with them when they went back to town. The day before they left the cottage for the summer, Alice heard in the post office that the innkeeper's wife was getting a divorce. Emily was sitting on the worn linoleum, sorting through her summer collection of shells and stones, trying to select the ones that would fit into the single box her mother had agreed she could take home. She stopped her activity, looked up at her granddad. "There won't have to be one now, will there?" she asked. He knew what she meant. "No," he told her, "not now." You've been listening to me read Summer Notes by Karen Parker. I'll be right back with my next story here at Left Hanging 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Stay tuned. I'm back with Left Hanging here at 104.3, and I have another story for you. This one is by George Batst, and it's called Mary Mary, Quite Contrary. After a restless, sleepless night, Mary Langtree got out of bed and put on a robe, went to the kitchen where she got the coffee going. While the electric percolator chugged away, she went outside
into her small, well-kept garden at the rear of the cottage. She yawned and stretched her arms while staring at the sky, where the first light of dawn seemed to be having a struggle establishing itself. She wondered if today would be another scorcher. It was only mid-June, and already the kind of hot, uncomfortable weather that belonged to August. There was rarely weather like this where she came from. Where all comes from, she told herself in a southern accent. Mr. Milken, her boss, owner of the KZ coffee shop in the West 30s of 7th Avenue, where Mary worked as a counter waitress, frequently commented, "Where did you get that accent? It's like no accent I ever heard down south." During the war, Mr. Milken had been stationed at an assortment of established installations and camps in an assortment of southern states, always a cook but never a hero. And Mary continued to explain patiently, "I've been talking like this here way since I was a toddler." Lulu Dobson, Mary's friend and co-worker, wisecracked, "That accent straight out of Gone with the Wind." They had met 3 years earlier when Mary first arrived in New York, alone, friendless, and with no prospects. The girl struck up a conversation while standing in line to see a hit movie, and after the movie, over coffee, Lulu learned that Mary was perilously short of funds and in need of a job. "Ever sling hash?" she asked Mary, who was hungrily slicing into a very damp, melted cheese sandwich, her left hand holding the fork that she was swiftly piloting into her mouth. "Sling hash?" she asked. "Waitress," said Lulu, pouring sugar into her coffee. "That's what I do. Base pay is union and the tips are good." She described the KZ shop's location in the heart of the garment district, where the tips were abnormally generous. "It wouldn't take me long to get the hang of it, do you think, love?" "Love?" asked Lulu. Yes, said Mary with a warm smile. "Love. That's a term of endearment where I comes from. My mammy and my pappy always called each other and everybody else love. It's just an old habit." "It's kind of nice," said Lulu. "I like it. Anyway, you look like you've got strong hands. I'm sure you can juggle dishes along with the best of us. The trick is to see if Milken," that's the boss's name, "is in the market for extra help." As luck had it, Mr. Milken was in the market for extra help, mostly because he was in the market for Mary. Mary was a handsome woman, though to Lulu it was obvious her hair was too heavily hinted and her eye makeup was just a shade overdone. But Mary's figure was good and her legs were shapely and strong, and in just a few days she was slinging hash like an expert. She continued living at the YWCA until Lulu told her about a bungalow that had become vacant down the street from where she lived with her mother in Canarsie. "Canarsie? Where's Canarsie?" Mary's face was screwed up like a child having difficulty making a candy purchase. Lulu laughed. "It's the tip of Brooklyn, honey, on Jamaica Bay. I've lived there since I was a kid. Mom and I have been together in the house for over 5 years now. We lost Dad 6 years ago, and 5 years ago was when my rotten boyfriend went back to his wife. So I moved back home because it was cheaper that way. Listen, come on home with me tonight and after work. You can look at the bungalow and see if it suits you. It's on a not very nice street, but it's quiet." "Does it have a garden?" The question was put softly, almost wistfully. "Well, now," said Lulu, "I don't really know. It has a backyard, and I suppose if you've got a green thumb, you could fix it up real pretty." Then, as an afterthought, "You like gardening?" "I love it," said Mary with a passion Lulu privately thought should be reserved for a lover, not a hobby. "I love growing things. I love pretty colors and eating my own vegetables." That was 3 years ago, and now Mary was in her garden examining the bush that had reached its full maturity of 3 feet. Its bell-shaped flowers were in full blossom, flowers of alternating blue, purple, and dull red. Soon the berries would appear. Very black berries. Very lethal. Some unfortunate birds would peck at them and die, and Mary would give them a haphazard internment in the garbage pail, as she did with the birds of the previous 2 summers. Luckily, no neighbor children had invaded the garden and eaten the berries. She had taken the caution to warn some of her adjacent neighbors that the berries were dangerous. It didn't matter to the neighbors one way or another, especially the women, who treated Mary as though she came from outer space, let alone the deep south. Even Lulu had become somewhat remote and distant now that she had taken up with a new lover. That was fine by Mary. She treasured her privacy, and Lulu and her mother had had a habit, when Mary first moved into the bungalow, of dropping in on her unexpected and unannounced. Mary didn't like that. Soon they learned to phone first or wait for an invitation. Then after a while they ceased phoning, and Mary rarely invited.
Doesn't she have any men friends at all? Mrs. Dobson asked Lulu, shortly after Mary took possession of the bungalow.
She could have plenty, said Lulu, between sips of scalding coffee. But she turns them all off. Even poor old Mr. Milken stopped pinching her backside. You know what, Ma? I think he's afraid of her.
Oh, go on, not Milken.
Yes, he is. He said she said to him once, through very narrow slitted eyes,
do that again, Mr. Milken, and you'll lose those fingers.
Oh, go on. I swear on Papa's grave.
Mrs. Dobson shook her head solemnly while contemplating Mary's celibacy. Then she inquired of her daughter gravely. She's not queer or anything, is she?
Well, I've seen no signs, said Lulu with an authority she usually reserved for cab drivers. It isn't a matter of her not liking men. She just doesn't like, well, anybody.
Mrs. Dobson folded her arms and leaned back. She doesn't get any mail from down south.
How do you know that? The mailman told me. He was in for a cup of coffee and we got to discussing Mary because he's interested in her. And he told me she doesn't get anything but junk mail.
How about that?
Now Mrs. Dobson was leaning forward conspiratorially. Lulu, is it my imagination or is that accent of hers getting thicker?
Mama, I was wondering the same thing myself, Lulu sighed.
Well, indeed, she's a very peculiar person. Still, she calls everybody love.
But very insincerely, I'm sure, said Mrs. Dobson with a sniff as she helped herself to a third English muffin.
Now, 3 years later, Lulu was determined to get chummy with Mary again. The decision was due to no pressing urge of hers to revive the friendship. It had been pressed on her by Nick Abrams, one of the steady customers at the KZ coffee shop. Nick was a writer who lived in a reconverted loft just a few doors down from KZ. Nick's friend, Don Borelli, was Lulu's new lover. Nick had brought Don into the place for lunch, and as Don later explained to Lulu, you bent over to serve me a salad and it was love at first sight. Lulu almost cried because Don had been trying to make time with Mary and, of course, was getting nowhere. Now it was Nick's turn to suffer that frustration.
She's such a cold fish, Lulu insisted to Nick. Why bother?
I like a challenge. She fascinates me. Women of mystery always fascinate me.
Oh, go on, said Lulu with a disdainful wave of her hand. The only mystery she could see about Mary was why men were so interested in her.
And then one day came the dawn, and Lulu realized it was the mystery of unavailability that made Mary so desirable. Lulu herself had no patience with mystery and unavailability. Her hunger for men was earthly and honest.
Nick's pursuit of Mary never flagged. Every lunch hour he sat at her section of the counter, his eyes following her every move. His lunch diet never varied, a bowl of fresh fruit topped by a generous helping of cottage cheese. He flirted outrageously, but Mary never lost her cool. He tried to pique her in some interest in his writing, but she continued to reward him with a blank look and dull eyes.
I've got a very interesting new assignment, he told her one day between mouthfuls of cottage cheese as she was clearing dirty dishes from the counter. I'm doing a series of articles on women killers, he winked at her. Not people who kill women, but women who have killed. Are you interested in that sort of thing?
I like a good murder story sometimes.
You mean you like to read them?
Sometimes I like to read them.
I have a fine shelf of murder books up in the loft. Why don't you come up sometime and choose a few?
There's a bigger selection at the public library.
She walked away from him briskly with an armload of dirty dishes. Milliken, who had been watching them, said to Mary as she was about to enter the kitchen, can't you be a little nicer to the customers?
Mary nailed his face with her eyes.
Do I do a good job?
Yes, Mary, you do a good job.
Have I ever insulted a customer?
Never.
Do I earn my money?
Milken shrugged. He knew when he was beaten.
The uncertain smile on his face was all the answer Mary needed, and she continued into the kitchen.
Milken walked down the aisle behind the counter until he reached Nick, whom he liked.
Nick, baby, he said, why do you waste your time?
What do you mean?
Mary, why do you bother?
In your line, you must meet plenty of interesting ladies who don't give you a hard time.
Why do you bother?
It's hurting you?
No, I just hope it isn't hurting you.
It's not hurting me. I'm enjoying it. Today I'm getting someplace.
He smiled. She spoke three sentences to me.
Well, how about that, said Milken.
After lunch, Nick went to the main branch of the public library to research a series of articles on women murderers. He'd been at it for weeks, but he hadn't uncovered anything new or fascinating in the way of murderesses. Lizzie Borden, Winnie Ruth Judd, Ruth Snyder were all tried and trite.
Mrs. Jacobs, an assistant librarian, was sympathetic to Nick's problem. "We have an excellent collection of foreign murder suits." "They've been done to death, too," countered Nick, adding with a pixie grin. "No pun intended." "No pun detected," said Mrs. Jacobs. "You just haven't been probing in the right places, Mr. Abrams. You've been digging around in the old files. Why don't you try some of the new files? We have some interesting new material on a British murder case that shocked the English some 3 or 4 years ago. The murderer was never apprehended. It's a fascinating story. Come have a look." The following Friday, Lulu saw to it that she left the KZ with Mary and walked with her to Fifth Avenue, where they would get the bus to Canarsie. "Mary," said Lulu as they stood in line waiting to board the bus, "Mom and I miss the old closeness. I mean, we don't seem to see anything of you anymore." "I know," said Mary, pronouncing no as it, so that it emerged now. "It's all my fault. But you've been so busy with your boyfriend." "Isn't Don cute?" Mary managed to smile. "I mean, I know you showed him the back of your head when he tried to make time with you, but really, he's terrific." "How come you're not out with him tonight?" "He's helping Nick with his research." "Okay, all right. Now, how come you don't like Nick?" "I'm just not interested in getting involved with anybody." "Nick isn't anybody. He's a writer." "Big deal. He's doing this story on lady murderers." "He told me." "That's right. He said he told you. Well, he's come across this case that nobody in this country has ever written about." Mary was staring out the window. This woman in England who was suspected of murdering her entire family. She poisoned them all with some kind of fruit. Can you imagine? Mary continued looking out the window. She murdered her husband and his mother and father, and her own mother and father, and her two sisters, and both her brothers-in-law. "Quite a haul," Mary said. "And she got away with it. I mean, she went on trial and everything like that, and they couldn't prove she did it, even though she was growing the poison berry bushes in her own garden. They couldn't prove a thing, and now she's disappeared without a trace." Nick said one of the articles he read in a British newspaper suggested she might have gone to Australia to continue her acting. "She was an actress." Mary's voice was dull and flat. "An amateur actress, you know, local stuff. But the funny thing is, she'd made a big hit in some play about a Scottish poisoner named Madeline, something who had poisoned her kid brother and got away with it. And they think it was this play that inspired her to do away with her family." Lulu sighed. "I don't tell it too good. When Nick tells it, I get goose pimples. Nick told me to tell you. He thought you'd be fascinated with the story." Mary turned to Lulu, who was rummaging in her handbag. "Why would the story fascinate me?" "Well, you being a gardener and all that." Lulu found her makeup and was lavishly rouging her lips. "I told him about those berries you grew. Killed those poor little birds." "Making me a murderer, too." Lulu looked up and was surprised to see that Mary was smiling. "Oh, no, come on. I mean, like I told Nick about all those pretty things you grow besides the vegetables you eat and the berry bush with the pretty, it was the prettiest of all. I mean, you still grow that bush, don't you?" "Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, thanks for reminding me. The berries are out. I must pick them and throw them away." "Listen, Mary, I know you don't think I'm getting out of line when I tell you this, but Nick's really got a case on you." Mary echoed softly. "Nick's got a case on me." "He and Don are coming out to dinner here with Mom and me tomorrow night. Why don't you join us?" Mary was staring out the window again. "I'll make him promise to behave." "Oh, he always behaves." "Well, you know what I mean. Not push too hard, that sort of thing. He's going to tell Mom all about this murderess." "Now, what was her name again?" Mary started to speak, but Lulu beat her to it. "Nancy Perkins, that was her name. I remember they called her the Belladonna Killer. And those berries were filled with arsenic or something like that." She fell silent and hummed under her breath for a few moments. Then she resumed speaking. "Can you imagine anybody killing so much family?" "They must have gotten on her nerves." The story hints she was in love with someone the family didn't like. I mean, she'd been cheating on her husband with just about everybody in the amateur acting company, and there was this guy, a butcher, I think, she was planning to run off with. But the husband was tipped off by a jealous woman, and so he and the brothers-in-law got rid of him. I think he just sort of disappeared. Mary coughed, reached into her bag, found a handkerchief and blew her nose. Lulu stared at her. "You catching a cold or something?" When Lulu got home, she said to her mother, "You'll never believe this. You'll absolutely never believe this." Mrs. Dobson's eyes widen with joy. She claps her hands together. Don's asked you to marry him. Oh, no, nothing like that. Mary's coming to dinner tomorrow, Mrs. Dobson said now. I don't believe it. She is, and what's more, she said, don't worry about dessert. She's going to bake something special, a real old-fashioned down-south pie filled with all sorts of fruits. Well, won't that be nice? I'm real glad she's coming. I really am. You say this Nick is sweet on her? Well, maybe she's loosening up at last. I mean, my gosh, living alone all these years without any companionship at all? I'm really glad she's coming. Now I know it'll be a real bang-up dinner. In her garden, Mary was collecting berries into a mason jar. Softly, she sang to herself, Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? And she chuckled and whispered to herself, Why, honey child, it grows really useful. And that's how it grows. You've been listening to me read Mary, Mary, Quite Contrary by George Baxt. And this has been Left Hanging with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed the stories. And now, on to new letters on the air already in progress. Till next time. Good night.